Blog Talk Radio.
Beunique works to change the world for a better tomorrow, using digital mediums to connect the dots of the world through professional storytelling. We have all embracing, all-inclusive heart and are always learning to create new things, to revitalize and sustain old things. While recognizing our differences, we use positive and universal thinking to strategize for a positive outcome. We collaborate people of all distinctions to create a better me, a better you, a better us. By caring for others, there's no room in our hearts for hatred, racism, or egoism. So, let our visions heal and keep the promises of what we will be. One day, by living helpful, caring, and happy, healthy, and essential lives. With the wonderful staff and volunteers at Beunique, we will continue to pursue that dream by making the world a better place for everyone. From everyone at beunique.org, to our readers and listeners, thank you for all your support. There's so much more on the way.
All right, everybody. Mr. Rudy Schur. We're going to be discussing his life in publishing and much, much more. But Mr. Schur, before we begin, I just want to make sure it's okay. I just do a little house cleaning real quick and we'll get right into it. Before we begin, again, I want to thank everybody for joining us here tonight on Thursday. Thank you for spending your Thursday evenings with us. Just want to talk a little bit about Beunique. We're proud here at the Beunique family, and the Beunique magazine is something that we really strive and work with to try to change the world and make it a more positive place. But more importantly, the mission of Beunique is to work today to change tomorrow, using digital mediums to connect the world with professional storytelling. We work to educate, inspire, and foster positivity, create creativity worldwide, and through video, audio, and the magazine itself, we are on our way. Okay. All right. Hey, Rudy, you there?
I'm here. Yes.
All right. You know, thank you for putting up with all the house cleaning aspects of this show. I really want to welcome you this evening to Unscripted. And before we begin, I really want to thank Rudy, and it's a personal thing with us here because we had a last minute cancellation, and we called Mr. Schur up at the very last minute, and he was gracious enough to say, well, I can make it, I can do the Thursday night. So again, Rudy, thank you very much for joining us. We are greatly appreciative. So
as long as there's no tests, I'm fine.
I can assure you.
Thank you.
I can assure you. Well, and I may call you Rudy, correct? I just want to
Please.
Be sure. I want to be polite. My mom spent years and years and years and years with me with that character trait. But it's amazing. You know, I've been reading all about you, and I've been trying to kind of assimilate all of the information. And what a career that you've had. But the one thing that I didn't find, and I probably should have spent more time, was before you began your career in publishing, before you really started, you know, moving in that direction, what did you want to do growing up when you were a child, when you were a kid, when you were a teenager, when you were in high school? What did you see yourself doing?
That's relatively simple. I had no clue. I know that sounds weird.
No, it doesn't, because
honestly,
I'm with you.
Yeah, my parents were both immigrants coming right after World War II to the United States. I was born in a DP camp, a displaced persons camp in Germany, and so an American displaced camp in Germany. And so a year later, we came to the U.S., and essentially, from nothing, my father himself started working in a bakery and eventually owned the bakery. And as a kid, I used to work in the bakery. And I never wanted to be a baker. But then again, I wasn't sure what the hell I was going to be.
Well, when you were working the bakery, and your father was probably getting you up real early in the morning saying, hey, it's time to make the donuts or whatever, you were probably like, this is the last thing I want to do with the rest of my life is be back here with the bakery.
I wasn't that smart. I thought that all kids had a job after school in some place, and mine was working at a bakery. So essentially, when you grow up, not necessarily playing ball or whatever, but you're growing up in a closed family situation, you kind of make do with what you have. And essentially, it was interesting that I really became friends with both the bakers in the back and the sales girls. And so, you know, I was just growing up. I just enjoyed TV. I liked comic books. But essentially, I was clueless. And the fact that I got into publishing was just a coincidence, an accident, that I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. And for whatever reason, I said yes to a particular job, and that started my direction as to becoming eventually a publisher.
That's amazing. So you know you're going to have to tell us where you were and what it was that gave you that entry into the world of publishing. What happened? What was the situation?
Well, at a certain point, I had gotten married, and I needed a job. I knew I didn't want to work in the bakery, but it was, you know, there. However, I kind of felt it wasn't my particular thing. And my father understood that, which was fine. So I went to this very nice lady's house in the city who was somebody who provided jobs. And she said she had three things open. One was to work with a British airline company, freight company, and I'd have to stay in England for 5 months, 6 months, and they trained me. And having just gotten married, I didn't think that was such a great idea.
Probably not.
And I left that one just not telling my wife, going, you know, the Beatles
Smart
are
man.
Great, and I'm in England, and I'll get you all the albums. She wouldn't have wanted that. So the other job was, and I still can't believe there's such a job, a tourist guide that would take well-to-do couples around the world. I'd have to learn a little bit about every spot, but the job wouldn't pay a lot, but I'd see a lot, and I'd live on tips. And again, that wasn't really a good thing for somebody who had just gotten married. Honey, I'll be back in a year and a half. We'll make some money, but don't worry about it. I'll enjoy myself. The third job was as a sales representative for a college textbook publishing company. And I said, that's with books, right? And the woman said, yes, that's with books, yes. And I said, maybe I can go for an interview and, you know, see if I could get a job. That's exactly what happened. So she set up an interview, and I went down there, met a wonderful salesperson who worked for the company who did the interview, Ian O'Leary, with a great British accent, and we just hit it off. I mean, it was one of those things in which we sat down. He barely talked about books. We were just talking about life. And he said, I think you'll do quite well with this job. Would you be interested in taking it? And I said to myself, job, offer, yes, I will take that job.
Don't forget
and
Mary.
Essentially that
Don't forget
was
Mary.
It. And I was really surprised. As I said, I had this terrible-looking suit. I'd never really gone in for a real interview before. And so it was just one of those things where you meet somebody, you hit it off, and it turns out to be something you're going to wind up doing for the rest of your life.
Now, when you got to the job, I mean, was it something that there was a learning curve with, or did you feel like you were just completely naturally acclimated to do the job?
Okay, so it wasn't anything like working in a bakery. I can tell you that right away.
So the apron didn't work. Okay.
The apron didn't work. I couldn't slice any of the books. The bottom line was the location of the office headquarters was in Columbus, Ohio. I think the furthest I had been out of New York was New Jersey. And so I took a plane to Columbus, spent a week sitting at a desk in front of the head salesperson, and he literally read all the descriptions of every book they had to me. The key was not to fall asleep or do something really stupid. And I was able for 1 week to kind of look at him, smile, and hopefully do enough coffee to keep me up so that I could listen to what he was going to tell me the next hour. So that was great. And then at the end of the meeting, he said, okay, here's the key to your car. And I said, excuse me? Yeah, that's wasn't exactly what I said, but I said, car? And he says, yes, it's a company car. You'll have to drive it back to New York, and you can use it. We'll give you gas, and it's, you know, it's yours to go to all the colleges. And I said, great. How do I get to New York? As I said, I was lucky I was
way
able to get to Jersey, let alone to back to New York. In any case, I got the car, drove home, came into the house, and I said, hon, I got a car. And she said, I thought you were going for a job. And I said, it comes with the job. And she says, great. So we can drive to our mother's this time. And I said, yes, we can drive to your mother. Okay, no more trains.
Exactly the first place you wanted to go in your car.
And that was basically it. So essentially, I had the car, I had a job, and I had to now go from college to college talking to the people who taught the specific courses that the books were supposed to be adopted for. These people, professors, would choose a text the semester before they had to begin. Sometimes they would never give up the text they used. In other cases, they were always happy to switch. So as I went through this particular process, for the first couple of weeks, it was rather embarrassing. And to be honest with you, it was really different than working in a bakery going, can I help?
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah, I could see that closely. So I went into the professor's office. I opened up a book of the list of titles we had, and then I began to mumble whatever the hell it was I was trying to tell him. And he looked at me and said, you're new at this. And I shook my head, yes. And he said, give me the book.
What gave it away?
Yeah. Well, so he took the book. He looked at the fact that it was political science. He turned to the section, and he said, okay, let's look at some of the books you have to see if they would fit. And so he went through the thing, and from there we just started to talk about the fact that this was a new job for me. And he said, well, you're not the first sales rep to come in and talk about this. And what happens is you will get comfortable and you will understand what you need to tell me. But at the very end, even though that was part of the job, I discovered that it had to do with becoming friends with the people who you were talking to. And over the course of the years I spent on the field, that's what happened. I mean, they would take their time to look at the book. But if the book wasn't good, they weren't going to use it. However, if they felt that they could trust you, that you were telling them that this wasn't a bad book, they potentially would be able to use the book for their courses. Mm. And so I was very lucky, and within the first year, I was their number one new sales rep. And I think the part of the reason was the people who had worked in the New York territory had never left their home. So so the territory had not really been worked for several years. So as I actually went to these places and gave away the books, I got the adoptions. And so as I said, it was surprising to me, but it was an interesting lesson in learning how to be a salesperson.
Well, you're sitting there and you're obviously establishing relationships, and I think one of the good aspects is that you have people that recognize that, hey, you know, this person's just starting out. What can they do? Let me see what you have. And then from there, I mean, you're doing what every good salesperson does, and that is they build a client base. They get to know what their client needs. They get to know what their client wants, and you just go from there. And you know, getting a car, getting a job, and then, you know, going out and finding that you can do this job, to me, it sounds like you were already ready to go in this type of position. You know, just chatting with you now and knowing, you know, and learning how this happened with you, you know, it's definitely, you put people at ease. And that's an
Thank
important
you,
aspect. No, well, you do. Nobody's going to buy anything from somebody who walks in the door and says, "Hi, my name's Charlie Manson. I'm here to sell you a book." You know?
I would probably get their attention, though.
Well, it would. Yeah, it would. They'd probably quickly move to the phone. But no. When you started out doing this, it sounds to me, and please, you know, let me know if I'm wrong. It sounds to me like you kind of had it already figured out that this was something that you were very interested in and something that you make a career out of. Is that correct?
That is correct. But the thing was, it just fell into place. That professor took the time to say,
"That's where I was going.
Listen, kid, give me the book. This is not going to be as hard as you think. I will look at these things happen." Now, I could have, over the years that I had done that, I had run into some professors who would have thrown me out of the room. I mean, but in this case, it was just one of those opportunities where the guy was so nice, so understanding, and at that point in my life, just as I had met that sales guy who gave me the job, here is a professor who just understood and helped me. And I think that to some degree, given my own strange background, it was helpful. And it did direct me to where I would go. But as I said, it was more at that point as an adventure, because I wasn't 100% sure what I was going to do, but I did understand that I kind of liked what I was doing. I had just graduated college a year before, and all of a sudden, I'm back at college, except this time I can go on the campus, park where all the professors park, and walk around campus. It was great. And so, you know, I was about a year older than anybody on campus, and it looked like it. But as I said, it was one of those things. It was great. And yes, it probably at one point said, "This is what I want to do." But really, it wasn't anything overt, because I just still wasn't 100% sure. I knew what I liked, but things fall into place. And that's what happened with me. As I got the next job from another publishing company, I was made not just an associate editor. And I could go to campuses and look for books to give to the publisher that I was working with in Dubuque, Iowa. And again, that was another leap of faith that I had to go to. But they didn't give you a car, but they did pay you for the use of your car.
I bet your wife was very disappointed in you.
Yes, but they were paying me
what,
a lot
no
more
car?
Than the first company.
Well, then you made up for it right there, because I'm sure that put a big, bright smile on her face. You don't got a car, but we're making more money? Sounds like a great
but,
deal,
but
Rudy.
The thing was, right, but the thing was, finding professors and working with them on books, that struck a deep nerve. I mean, I really kind of enjoyed talking to people who had a project that wasn't sure how to put something together, and I was there, which was unusual, as an editor is normally located in their particular home office. Here, the travelers were also associate editors, and so they taught us various aspect of what we should do when we find a project and how to put it together and then send it in. That's what I really liked. And I did that for about 3 or 4 years. And at one point to myself, I said, you know, I'm pretty good at this, and I know so much about this, I'm going to start my own publishing company. However, because I am dyslexic, I couldn't do the math. I knew that. I knew that one of my weaknesses was the ability to figure out how to balance books, do the things that a business should have a hand on from the inside. And so I asked my best friend, Lee Solomon, if he wanted to become a partner in a new business. And Lee said, are you kidding? I got a job. I'm an engineer. Why would I want to?
Why do I want to go into business with you?
He said, okay, he says, this is what I'll do. I'll work part-time. I'll do the business side. I'll do the math. And you go out and you do what you need to do, and we'll move forward that way. And so I started the company with Lee, only to discover that what I thought I knew was barely what I should have known. So as the years went by, I learned various lessons on what to do and what not to do. And so
we
and
all
so
do that,
it, yeah, well, yes. But, you know, when you have a family, people are depending on you, and you're just looking forward and saying, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, and it actually happens, it's really cool. So through the course of the development of my first company, which was called Avery Publishing Group, my wife's brother, Ken Rajman, had just graduated college, and I said, Ken, why don't you come in and you can be a salesman, and we can go out and look for books and do the things we need to do to sell. And so as years went on, he excelled at what he did. My partner Lee gave up his job as an electrical engineer and came in full-time at this company. And so all of a sudden, we were a real company. And lucky enough to find various niches that helped support the operation. So what we were doing that a lot of other publishing companies weren't was, for one, we were doing textbooks. That was my basic knowledge. Then we started to publish books in the maternity area. People who are pregnant needed books. And what we did was we found organizations throughout the country that had their own programs, and we went there and we said, would you be interested in writing your own book for your people? And they said, sure. And we said, great, publish it. And so in those days, there were places that would have 2,000 to 3,000 pregnant couples come through each year, and they would need those books. We would then take those books and see if we could also sell them to other groups like them. And if they didn't want their book, then maybe they'd want their own book published. And so we set that up. And then eventually, although I seem to be doing all the talking, we accidentally got into the area of health. Alternative health was just starting out. And a friend of mine at
Rudy, if I can interrupt real quick, what year when you started going into the alternative health aspect, what year are we talking? Is this the late 70s, early 80s? Or when did this start really unfolding? Right.
Probably we started around 1980.
Okay.
1980. And a friend of mine, who was a printer, had told me about a cookbook that he was printing and for an organization, an institute up in Boston. And they didn't seem to be able to have enough books because every time he would ship books up there, they'd order another bunch of books to be printed because they kept running out of books. And he said, I don't know, you know, the book is ugly as sin, and I don't know what the heck they're doing, but you ought to check it out. And so I said, give me the name, and I will check it out. Ooh. And it turned out to be a place called the Hippocrates Health Institute up in Boston. And there was a lady named Ann Wigmore, who was the woman who started the wheatgrass craze, juicing wheatgrass. Mm. And so I called the place up, and I said, is there a way to speak to Ann? And the person I spoke to said, no, but I can put you to through to the director, who is Mr. Stephen Blauer, and he might be able to help you. So I called him up, spoke to him. He invited me up there, and I drove up to Boston, and I looked at this beautiful building in downtown Boston. I walked in, and the place was just jumping. Tons of people all over the place, classes being held throughout the building, and there was juicing. There was how to grow your own plants, how to grow your own wheatgrass, all these things. And so Steve and I spoke.
For a textbook. It had to
happen. Well, forget about the textbook at this point. I was looking at a cookbook, and it was a raw vegetarian cookbook. And I had never heard of such a thing. And, again, having grown up in a bakery, all I knew was what you eat in a bakery and any fast food stuff that was nearby you'd go to. So this was generally something I had never actually thought about.
Mm.
So he and I spoke about the possibility of us publishing the book. And he said, why don't you take a couple of these other things we put together, look at it, and then we'll talk and see how it works. So I took some of the books back, and over the course of a couple of weeks, Steve and I spoke several times. And at a certain point, he said, why don't you try the diet yourself? Why don't you go on some kind of raw vegetarian diet? And I'm going, this is going to kill me. But
I'm a baker.
I'm not going to tell my father, but I will do that. That's what I'll do. So for the first 3 days, I was eating carrots and the lettuce and tomato, whatever the heck it was that I was eating.
And loving every minute of it, I'm sure.
I wouldn't say I was loving every minute of it, no. But I wasn't such a great cook, and my wife going, what the heck are you doing? And I go, don't ask. Yeah, I'm going to do this. So on day three, I woke up, and for the first time in my life, I could breathe. And I'd always had a sinus condition where when I'd wake up, my head was like pounding. It was always stuffed. My nose was stuffed. It was terrible. And so sometimes it was worse. Other times it wasn't as bad, but it was always stuffed. The third day I woke up, and I noticed I wasn't making noise out of my nose. I said to myself, I can breathe. I can breathe. And I just was dumbfounded. I woke him up or something, and I said, Stephen, I can breathe. And he said, you probably didn't realize, but you had an allergy to something like milk or lactose or something, cheese, and it would clog your sinuses, and you never knew it. And he was right. And so I said, you know, I'd really like to publish your book. Let's do it. And so I took the book. We basically typeset it. We had it edited. We looked at it. As much as a publisher can look at a book to make it look good,
right.
And we produced it, and it started to sell.
Mm.
It started to sell to bookstores and health food stores, and this was a marketplace that, again, was kind of new to us because we were really looking at either places that were having babies or colleges, and
right.
So here we had these health food stores that carried books that we discovered they would sell to their patrons. And as Stephen and I kept talking, we wound up publishing about 3 or 4 more of those books from the Institute, and they started to sell. Mm. And again, we discovered this marketplace that was just beginning. Alternative care, alternative medicine was catching on. All of a sudden, magazines, the popular magazines, mm-hmm. started to do all sorts of things about places like the Hippocrates Health Institute. I then read an article about this other place in Boston called the Kushi Institute. And Michio Kushi was into macrobiotics. He was one of the leaders of the macrobiotic movement. And I could have said that 100 times, and I had no clue what I was saying. Macrobiotics.
But you're very convincing.
Yeah, really convincing. But I would always be honest and say, I've heard of macrobiotics, but what the heck is it? And so in the same instance that I called up Hippocrates, I called up Michio's place and asked if I could have an appointment, went up there, and met with, and by the way, if the first place was really nice, the second place had been a finishing school for women. And it was beautiful as well. It was large. It had giant rooms. And so I was led to...
And the napkins were well folded. Okay.
Probably, but I was never taken to the dining room. However, I was taken to the library.
Okay.
And there stood Michio Kushi surrounded by a number of, I guess, the teachers that he worked with, all wearing mm-hmm. ties and jackets. And as a publisher, I had to wear a tie and jacket, but it was completely different from the Hippocrates Institute because everybody there looked like hippies, while everybody at the other place looked like they were teaching college courses.
Mm.
So I met Michio, we spoke, and he had shown me some books that had been published, English language books that were published by a Japanese publishing company that he was not happy with because they didn't know how to sell books in the United States and relied on him to sell the books. And I said, that's unusual. It's not bad for them, but it's not your normal relationship with a publisher. And eventually I became their publisher. And at that point, macrobiotics started to explode as well as raw vegetarian. And again, that also fit into the health market. Over the course of about 20 years or so, Avery had become the largest alternative health publisher in the country. And it just happened. I mean, it was fascinating to be involved in it.
And I want to stop right there because there's something that I'm noticing, you know, throughout this conversation. And that your discoveries of this, of the diet and the discovery of the alternative health business growing sounds to me that it became a passion for you because of its effect on you, because of you noticing the difference in the quality of your life by actually following some of the examples that you were reading about or learning about. And
that's true.
Obviously, you are definitely very passionate about what you were doing and are continuing to do. And that seems to me that, you know, that's something that was fueling this entire scenario as you moved along. It sounds to me like you have found situations in your life or things that happen that you latched onto, and it opens all of these different doorways that you've walked through. And I mean, I'm sitting. You're talking about the microbiotics and all of these concerns with what people are eating and what people are. And I mean, you're like 30 years ahead of this incredible, you know, explosion that we have right now, with people, you know, going gluten-free and that time, people realizing that what they're eating has a direct effect on how they feel and their health. I mean, you're way ahead. This is the 80s.
It was, and as I said, a lot had to do with simple blind luck. as I said, it's one of those things where if the opportunity comes in front of you and you don't necessarily take advantage of it, it passes you. You'll never know whether it would have been good or it would have been bad simply because you never pursued it. In some cases, if you see something that you think may be of interest to you and you follow up, either it's going to be good or it's going to be bad, but the bottom line is at least you're doing something. And
right.
You know, saying yes to that job was kind of a godsend. Getting the car wasn't bad either. But but having met the people I met, I learned a great deal about health, about human nature in regard to how these people conducted their own lives. These people didn't necessarily care about money at all. What they cared about is the health of people who they came in contact with. And as Stephen Blauer had been kind enough to simply talk to me about this, in a million years, I would have never wanted to give up ice cream or cake or cookies or anything like that. But
anything in a bakery. Nothing in a bakery.
Wasn't in the. Meanwhile, I could have had as much ice cream as I wanted. It was in the bakery. but the bottom line was I learned that it wasn't good. It was, you know, in many cases, the underlying. In one of the early books I also did was a book called Lick the Sugar Habit by Nancy Appleton. And she had produced this a book published by a large New York publisher who had printed 10,000 copies of the book. And then, because she complained about the fact that they didn't help her market the book, once the book was out, they ran out of inventory, they basically put her book out of print and gave her the rights back. I took that book over. We had basically met at a meeting, and she said, you know, sugar is addictive. And even though you like the things you like, the reason you like them is because your brain is basically set to want it. Just like the heroin addict wants heroin, you want ice cream. Just like an addict at the end of a dinner, you eat a full course meal. At the end, you're full. And what do? You order dessert, just what you need. Your brain is saying, I need this. It's not that you need to have it. It's just that your brain dictates the fact that, just like smoking, you want to have this thing. And so she basically kind of filled in a lot of the holes that I wasn't aware of as well. So the process of moving forward with the right people was always interesting and was helpful in regard to moving with the right individuals who then helped guide me to other people who were just as wise as they were. And as I said, it was an exciting time, and it especially in those days when it was just breaking open. As I said, this was what people looked at as a hippie movement.
The
hippies had gotten older.
Exactly. You went to the right place. I was saying is that this must have been at that time such a foreign concept of an idea. Because I remember growing up and it was like, make sure you eat all your Apple Jacks. You know, and stuff for breakfast. I mean, none of it. I mean, I was very fortunate in that my mother did have a come to God moment, and then all of a sudden I woke up and there were no more Apple Jacks in the cupboard. But you know, and she really started focusing on healthy eating and to the most extent vitamins. Vitamins. I must have taken 9 different vitamins a morning, and I used to, you know, I used to get real good at hiding them behind the bookshelves because I just didn't want to do it. But I am so grateful now, looking at the effect it's had in my later years, as to I didn't have asthma, I didn't have all of these different types of allergies that unfortunately a lot of kids have, Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, and I'm, I have two nephews who, they're not autistic, but it's more like Asperger's. And the diet that my sister-in-law initiated and researched, could have been an Avery book, really just made a difference, and you see it. But, I mean, here you are, it must be what, the mid-80s?
Mid-80s.
Yeah, and you're right. People are looking at this because they're probably like, well, this is some kind of hippie concept, you know. But you're way ahead because now, you know, of course, you know, 30, 40 years down the road, we're going to realize all of that as a scientific fact. But, I mean, for you as a person who's going to get, you know, this information out in the publishing world, did you feel like you were taking a chance or did you know that this was going to be something that was going to build momentum?
That's really interesting. Honestly, I discovered that I loved what I was doing, that as we move forward, we were getting more and more recognition as a young, upstart, independent publishing company that seemed to have a direction that other publishers didn't. And you know, one of the interesting things initially was that I would go out and look for authors. That's, you know, that's what I was trained to do, and that turned out to be fine.
Let me ask you this. In the age of the no internet, how were you accumulating your research? How were you finding these authors? Because basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rudy, it sounds like some of this would be on, like, what would be considered the fringe side. How did you find these particular folks?
People to people. I would basically – one of the things, for example, when I worked with the macrobiotic people, they had their own magazine called East West Journal. And I'd become friends with the publisher, and I wound up publishing books for the East West Journal. And through that, I met many of the writers who worked for East West Journal. They, in turn, discovered that, hey – this publishing company is publishing books for the journal. Maybe they'd be interested in my project. So I'd go up there, and then they'd meet with me. And as I said, it was at that point going out and looking for people who seemed to be in tune with the kinds of things that happen. But at a certain point, one of the first people to give me a call was a very nice lady named Dr. Shari Lieberman. Shari was a nutritionist, a registered dietitian who had a PhD as well.
Okay.
She had a book that had been published by by Doubleday. And they had printed the book, just like the woman who did the book on sugar, and they put it out of print, even though it had sold 20,000 copies. 20,000 copies. And she said, what was the problem? And I said, well, we don't follow this philosophy. And she called me and said, would you be interested in talking to me about my new book? And I said, sure, come on in. I was thrilled that somebody actually knew our phone number and wanted to talk to me. So she came in, and she had explained to me what happened to her at Doubleday, and I said, well, what's your book about? And she said, it's about supplements. So you talked about vitamins and minerals. And she said, do you know anything about the guidelines that the USDA puts out? And I said, only that they tell you how much you need per day. And she said, well, that's not necessarily the right way to look at it. And then she explained to me what the USDA did in the 30s and 40s was they discovered what the minimum amount of nutrients you needed to stave off a disease like scurvy or rickets. They would take prisoners and feed them very little nutrients up until the time that a disease would form in their body. And then they figured out that that's the minimum amount somebody needed to take on a daily basis to keep scurvy away. She said, that's really a terrible use of nutrients. Your body needs more. You don't need less. You need more. And so she had spent, her PhD was based on the study that she had done looking at all the research that said the more of specific vitamins and supplements you take, the more likely it is you'll be healthier. So if you take more vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin A, it would work for you, not against you. And the fact that the government is telling you that you need just this is not a good thing. And she said what happened with her first book is that before her, if you were to put too many vitamin suggestions that went over and above the government's suggestion, the publisher didn't want to publish it. And I said, so they want to keep these things as low as possible? He says, well, that's just the way the country is. They're looking at minimum. They don't really want to know about more vitamins and more minerals. And so I said, let's put together a book and let's do it. She said, that's why I'm here. So she went into a bag, pulled out a manuscript, and said, here's the book. Take a look at it.
Well, she was ready for you.
And over the course of the years, that book sold over a million copies.
Man, you were right there. Now, I want to stop you right there because earlier in our conversation, and this is a really one of the aspects I really like to talk about, is that you are working with all these authors. You're working with these authors that are basically at that time on the fringe. You have your own company. Is there, when you were given these projects, did you feel that you had to look at them, you know, run away with the material, look at it and make sure, hey, this is on the up and up or this is well written? And if that, and having had to do that, or if you did have to do that, you discover that you're dyslexic. Now, does that pose a problem in that, okay, I have all of this new interesting research coming at my company. I've got all of these authors that are online with something that is obviously making a difference. I've got to look into this. But did the dyslexia pose a I don't want to say a barrier, Rudy. I want to say, was it something that you really, knowing that you wanted to get this information out, knowing that you wanted these books published, but knowing that you also had to take a look at what they were giving you, what kind of obstacle was the dyslexia when you were dealing with these authors, these publishing these books, and getting this material out?
Well, by the time I had gotten into the business of publishing, I'd learned various tricks to be able to do what I needed to do in terms of reading. And the fact is that that was something I had to learn on my own because when I started out as a kid, I had a learning disability, but there was no such thing as learning disabilities. When I was a kid, my parents would take me to open school night to meet the teacher, and the teacher would say, you know, he seems so smart. What's wrong with him? And
Sounds like your mother and my mother used to have these conversations because the same thing.
Yeah, we probably had the same teacher.
But why is he like this?
So the thing was that they didn't understand that kids had problems. And so when I was growing up, I knew I had a problem, but I kept it to myself, and I always thought that other kids had the same problem as well, but they overcame it. In other words, if they did something, something in their head would snap, and it would become normal. So one day I would know which side was left and which side was right. I would eventually know that these letters aren't backwards. They're supposed to be A to Z, not Z to A.
Right.
However, I didn't know. And so What I did initially was when I was about 12 or 13, I started reading books.
Was that something you forced yourself to do?
Oh, baby. I had this bookmark, and it might have taken me 3 weeks, 4 weeks to read what a normal kid would take about 2 days to read, but I read it. And then I would write the name of the book down on my bookmark. Then I'd go to another book, and I'd read it and read it. And what would happen is I'd read a passage, and in my head I said, that doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense because I read it wrong. So I would reread it.
I'm sorry to interrupt. How did you know you read it wrong?
Because it made no sense.
I mean, this is something you had been going through, you know, entire life. I mean, how do I put this? Because, again, I'm trying to – you intuitively knew that –
Oh, yeah.
What you
I mean, the fact is you're reading a novel, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you're reading a passage, and it absolutely makes no sense because you reverse the verb with the noun or you missed a word, and you don't understand what it means. You then read it back slowly, and you realize that what you just read was wrong as you saw it.
Okay.
But here's the key. You don't scream or yell. You just accept the fact that you'll reread it again until you get it right. And so by the time I had finished writing all the names of the different books I had written on my bookmark, I discovered something that was really interesting. I like books. I enjoyed reading, not a normal way of reading, because I'm sure that when I see other people reading novels and it takes them a day or two or four, they go through a big book. It takes me twice as long, three times as long to read something, but I can do that. And I can also see where I miss something and then I go back. And so you teach yourself how to travel through any book so that it makes sense to you. Sometimes, oddly enough, you see something that wasn't there, and then when you talk to the author, he goes, you know, that's a really good idea. Maybe I should include it. And I'm going, wow, how did that happen?
Score.
Yeah, but the point is that it's one of those odd things that I had to grow up with. I had anything called dyslexia up until I saw a 60-minute segment about this girl who was going to Columbia University and wanted to tape her professor's lecture. Mm. And the professor said she was not allowed to do it. It turns out she was severely dyslexic and could not take notes. And the only way she could learn was to hear it rather than write it down. She sued Columbia University to allow her to tape it, and she won. As they're discussing her problem, I'm listening to them, and I'm going, I got that. I do that. That sounds like me. And then for the first time I realized I was dyslexic, but not as bad as her because there are degrees of dyslexia. I mean, she had a really terrible problem in the fact that she couldn't actually write. For me, I could write, not as well as other people, but I spent time and I did it. And so I started to read about dyslexia. And through the course of being able to publish books, one of the other areas that we also went into was learning disabilities. And that, too, kind of taught me a great deal in regard to the fact that there are a number of ways that you can treat learning disabilities that don't necessarily meet everybody's needs. they meet a specific person's need. And if that person benefits from it, say it's 2 out of 10, that person found their answer to how to get around their problem.
And
again,
and you know
that's
what, Rudy,
an issue.
You did that, though. You did that. Probably at this point, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've been trying to read, or you've been overcoming this dyslexia by the process you're using to read these books. So you reading the way you're reading is like me picking up a book and reading the way I'm reading, because you've been working with this workaround all of these years. But now you finally hear from the 60 Minutes interview that this is why this has happened.
Right.
And I bet you
right.
that was like a eureka moment.
Trust me, that was – It made me feel as though whatever I had wasn't just me.
Right.
See, you don't
did you,
go
did
around
it affect
telling
you personally,
people
though?
You can't read very well.
I mean, but was it something that – I mean, you knew you had this issue, but was it – I bet you it was such a relief to know that, you know what, I'm not alone in this. This isn't just
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm not, you know, I don't mean to say it this way, but I mean, you know, I'm not stupid. It's not a deficiency within myself. This is something that is a, you know, is an affliction, and that now it's got a name. And now I know that there's something there.
Enough, right. But I never really had I was lucky for whatever
mm-hmm.
reason that I didn't have a negative view of my issue. I just felt, okay, it stuck with me. While other people were able to overcome it for whatever reason, mine didn't go away. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to bring it up, but the fact is I know how to be able to force myself to read. I don't scream. I don't yell. I don't get frustrated. And then that, in fact, is a pretty good lesson just to go through life. But the point was that it had a name, as
yes, yes.
a number of learning disabilities now yes. have names,
yes.
and at least you can figure out that perhaps there is an answer.
Right.
I had, back to 60 Minutes, several years later,
Rudy,
I was
I'm
watching
sorry to,
60
I'm sorry
Minutes.
To
oh.
interrupt you, and this is what where I'm going with this. I, you know, we have barely touched on this subject and barely touched on more of what you are. Would you mind coming back sometime at another date so we can pick up this discussion? We're out of time, and I mean we could talk for hours.
Not a problem.
I mean, this is extremely, extremely interesting to me. And on a personal note, I mean, I saw my wife had dyslexia, and it was not diagnosed in high school, and we knew each other in high school, and she was very frustrated. And it really did interfere with some of her classwork, and it wouldn't be until she got to college that it would be diagnosed. So, you know, your attitude and response to what you were going through on top of the direction you were moving in your career, you were saying all these things kind of in the place. Well, just listening to you discuss on how your response was to this, you know, situation you have with reading says it all to me. Is this something – you know, you recognized there was an issue, but you didn't sit there and you didn't do anything about it. You figured out a way to get around it and to work it for you. And that attitude is something that, you know, is not common in a situation like that, especially when you're a kid. And I am really, Rudy, I am really sorry we are out of time, and I hope you will consider coming back, because I would really love to talk with you more on, you know, what you're doing at this moment and more on this and how you've overcome these obstacles. Would you come back if we
It's my pleasure, Tony.
All right. Hey, Mr. Shure, Rudy, number one, again, thank you so much for filling this last minute. And thank you so much for being an incredibly interesting person to talk with. It's not only inspiring.
Okay, if you could tell my wife that, I'd appreciate it.
It's very. Just let me know where I need to send a note.
You got it.
But listen, we are extremely happy to have had you, and I look forward. We will contact you later, and thank you so much for your time, and thank you for sharing your story and experiences with our audience tonight. I hopefully will be speaking with you soon, and again, thank you, and thank you for joining us this evening. It's been a pleasure.
Me too. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right. You have been having another wonderful guest and another wonderful episode. Oh my God, whatever.